hello, and today we're going to be speaking with Will. So hi, Will.
Hi.
And we're going to be talking a little bit about sort of, well, basically what's going on with the current the current Conservative Lib Dem government, and also just sort of getting putting this in context with sort of what's going on globally and things with the financial crisis. And so just to start off, just for people who maybe weren't around in the 80s, or people who maybe were around, but it's been a little while. Can you just give us an idea, just to sort of compare and sort of let us know how things are similar, or if things are different with the current Conservative Lib Dem government and the Tories of the 80s and things?
Okay, well, they I mean, to me, they feel very different. I suppose you'd say the similarity is that both the present government and Thatcher's government in the 80s have come to power saying they need to make big spending cuts. So that's what's the same. So from that point of view, there's a similarity. But I think in many other respects, they're very different. I think the government now is much weaker. I think Thatcher had, she was that was part of a very amazing change, really, in British politics and world politics. So she had a very strong political doctrine that did have big political support amongst the right in this country. So there was a big sort of big push behind her, big popular support on the one hand, but also she was bitterly opposed. So I think it was much more political division in the country back in the 80s. But also the nature of the cuts were very different. So in the 80s, part of her ideology was to privatise, nationalise industries. So large sections in those days of the large sections of industry were nationalised in this country, and so a big part of Thatcher's spending cuts were to privatise those companies, and to do that she had to smash the unions. So there was a succession of intensely bitter strikes, which culminated in the miners' strike of 84-85. And so there was enormous conflict around that. Now, in the UK of today, there are no nationalised industries. So to make cuts, Cameron and the Tory Liberal coalition have to attack benefits, really, or to cut military spending or health service spending. So there won't be the same. There certainly won't be the same big industrial conflicts with trades unions in order to force privatisation. And I think in many ways they're going to be, the Tories, if they want to save real money, they're going to be forced to go after the middle classes in England, which will make a very different feel to things, I think. So, you know, for instance, if you want to cut the public sector wage bill, really you have to go after people like the teachers or healthcare professionals. So that's a very different business than going after miners and steel workers. And it's yet to be seen if the Tories are going to be able to do it. So I think the feel's very different to me. It's early days yet, but I think the Tories and the Tory Liberal government in this country don't seem to me to be as scary or as confident as Thatcher did in the 80s, and I think they're going to struggle to make the spending cuts that they feel they need to. But we shall see.
Yes, indeed.
But the other thing is there isn't this big ideology behind it. I mean, that was what was so weird about the 80s was Thatcher had a real big ideology behind it. So it was all like spelt out in terms of argument, and you'd hear, you know, it was funny time in the 80s, but you'd hear people, ordinary people, sort of repeating Thatcherite ideas, you know, in on the bus stop or in the shops, you know, where you don't hear anybody now sort of quoting David Cameron to you, you know. I think quite a different feel. There's so many differences. I mean, another difference is, of course, it's a coalition government now, and so, you know, and a lot of us felt when the Liberals went in with the Tories that the Tories would eat them for breakfast, and it does look like that's what's happening. And so we now are going to watch the Liberal Party falling apart while the top of the Liberal, you know, the Liberal ministers are sort of going along supporting a Tory government, making, you know, putting up VAT and making, you know, cutting incapacity benefit, and whereas the Liberal rank and file in the country are going to be just screaming, you know. So, yeah, lots of differences, I think, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, indeed. And David Cameron's idea of the big society sort of seemed to fall flat during the election.
Yeah, yeah. I've got to say I don't think it resonated great echoes amongst people enthusiastically getting ready to be part of the big society, if you see what I mean. I mean, it's just talk. I mean, I think people just see it as empty talk, really. And I think people just feel same old Tories, public spending cuts. You know, I don't think people feel that there isn't much popular enthusiasm about the Tory government. But also they're not popular in the way Thatcher was very bitch. I mean, she was bitterly divisive, but she was very popular amongst a section of people. I mean, there was a real Thatcherite constituency in the country that really backed her 100%, you know. Sadly, God, you know. Anyway.
Indeed, yeah, definitely. And so back in the 80s, you know, the FDA and Reagan, in his infinite wisdom, tried to get tomato ketchup classified as a vegetable,
right,
and things. And I think one of the things that has been talked about is the what's going to happen with schools in the UK and things, and school lunches. So okay. Do you know a bit about what's going on with that?
I mean, all I can say, I'm no expert on education, but all I can say is the old sort of Labourist social democracy idea of comprehensive schools, which is like everybody goes to the same schools and you know, all kids from all families have the right to go to decent schools, which was sort of part of the 1945 Attlee government welfare state framework, and you know, was still around when I was a kid, and to some degree New Labour breathe some life back into, to the degree that they did build lots of new schools. They replaced a lot of the infrastructure. But I think there's a lot of suspicion that the Tory Liberal Democrat idea of people being able to set up their own schools is just a way of breaking, you know, further breaking up public sector education into nice schools for middle class families and shit schools for everybody else. I mean, I have to say that would be the suspicion in a lot of people's minds, you know, and that so the idea that kids from different backgrounds would all go to the same school and all kids can go to decent schools, I think there's a, you know, a lot of people think that the Tories, well, their real concern is just there's decent schools for middle class kids to go to and the rest can stuff it, really. And so particularly changes like allowing people to set up their own schools and breaking up local government control over education it will be part of that. And in Bristol, where we're speaking from, which is a very divided city, and public education is you know, a lot of kids go to private schools. You know, I suspect that after 5 years of the Tory Liberal coalition, the public sector school system in this city will be even weaker, and even more middle class parents will be opting out, you know, because of that. So that's how I see it going, you know. Mm-hmm. And it will be an interesting test of, I mean, the trade unions in this country are far weaker than they were in the 80s. But one of the areas that are potentially still very strong are the teachers. And, you know, the teachers are still fairly well organised. A relatively high proportion of teachers are still members of the union. And it will be interesting to see if the NUT, you know, are able to really, really kick up and fight the government effectively.
Yeah, the NUT is the National
Union. National Union of Teachers, yes, it's the biggest teachers' union in the UK. Mm-hmm. And I can't say I'm holding my breath, but I do live in hope, you know.
Indeed.
You know. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And so I was wondering as well, like, we've recently just seen in Toronto in Canada the G20 and the G8 that just happened, which was met with massive examples of police brutality and things, with over 900 people arrested, allegations of women being threatened with rape while being detained in cells, rape and also gang rape and things, racist comments, and also francophones and people of color and things being attacked as well, selectively attacked and profiled. Also a lot of young people being detained as well, as they're sort of trying to be discouraged to participate in actually having more of a say and control what goes on with their future on this planet. And so I was wondering, one of the things, the big things that came out of the G20 was this whole move towards austerity. And there was a bit of debate about this leading up to the summit, but it did sort of, that's what came out of this, was that it's going to be a new age of global austerity. I was just wondering if you have any thoughts about what is going to happen with this.
Yeah, I've got a lot of thoughts there. I mean, I went up to the G20 demonstrations when it was in London. Now, let me have a think. So this was March of 2009 when, you know, like a member of the public who wasn't actually even involved in the demonstrations was pushed over by the police outside the Bank of England and died. And it was tense. There was tense and bitter, really, there. And that was, you know, swamping by the police and using sort of anti-terrorism legislation as a way of so equating the demonstrators with terrorism as a way of trying to control the demonstrations. So, well, I mean, first thing I would say is, you know, it's really good that people have got on protesting, and good that people in Canada have had a real go at it, you know, because I do think it matters, because I think in a way, and I felt this when I was up at the G20 in London, was that I sort of feel that wherever it is in the world, you know, there has to be protest, and the people who are protesting are sort of protesting on behalf of everybody in the world, if you see what I mean. So I think it's great that it's really vigorously opposed. And I suppose by the same token, the fact that the forces of the state, you know, do police it with such, you know, violence and intimidation, sort of reflects the violence and intimidation that's used, like, around the world against the masses of people who ever try and resist authority. So so I think it's just a it always acts as a sort of microcosm of the world in general. So I'm glad they protested in Canada. Well, I'm not at all surprised there was a lot of violence from the state authorities, and I'm sure that will go on wherever it is in the world, you know. And they're going to end up having it on a bloody island somewhere in the middle of the Pacific, aren't they, in the end, you know, as a way of getting, you know. I just think it's great that wherever it is, there's trouble, really. As for austerity, I mean, I've been fascinated with the developments in the world economy in the last 2 or 3 years. I do think we live in we are just watching history being made, I think. And the great comparator is the 30s. I mean, we've been watching what's been going on in the last 2 or 3 years, and looking back at the economic crash in the 1930s, and seeing to what degree it's similar or different. Yeah, I think there's no doubt that many governments, Britain and in continental Europe particularly, have responded to, first of all, they bailed out the banks and took on enormous debts to do so, and now the markets are forcing nation states to impose austerity in order to bring down government debt. That's what's happening. The danger is, and Obama has been warning about this, and there's a lot of fear about it. The danger is that, you know, like countries compete to cut their public spending. There's a wave of austerity all around the world, and we all go into a massive deflationary slump. I mean, that's the fear, and I think those fears are realistic. You know, so we stand at a point where the markets are forcing governments to deflate, but the risk is that as more and more governments deflate, the world economy goes down the tubes, and we shall see what happens. But I think there's every likelihood that there's going to be a major sinking back into recession. You know. Mm-hmm. And certainly in the UK, with the level of public spending cuts that they're going to push through, it's hard to see there's going to be booming growth, you know, in the foreseeable future.
Yeah, indeed.
So,
And they keep talking about this, the Eurozone and sort of contagion and things like that, like contagion of what's gone on in Greece and things, where there's been loads of unrest and things as well.
Yeah.
And loads of proposed government cutbacks and things.
Yeah.
And also this might spread throughout southern Europe and all over the UK, where there's also quite a high debt load and things.
Yeah. And the markets are forcing it, isn't it? You see, that's the problem. It is like capitalism cutting its own throat. You know, so Spain and Portugal, you know, announced they were cutting their public sector work because pay by 5%, because Spain and Portugal were frightened that if they didn't take that step, you know, the currency markets would turn on them, and so they then take that step, so then the markets turn on the UK, and it goes round and round, but then you end up with a situation where all of the different governments are like slashing their public spending, and so growth goes down the tubes. So it is like a real contradiction of capital. It's very interesting. You know, I think it is very interesting to watch. You know, and you get to a stage where the markets are so agitated that, you know, like Molotov cocktails on the streets of Athens end up forcing the bond price down in Wall Street. You know, which is an extraordinary development, I think. And we'll see what happens, but they're a long way out of the woods, that's for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
There's also been this talk a bit among some people sort of saying they created the crisis, but yet we have to pay for it, and this idea that there's a major lack of economic justice and what's going on and things like this, because essentially it seems again that working class people, even middle class people now, are going to be sort of forced into this position to keep handing out money. One of the things I always thought was a bit strange was that in the United States, one of the reasons against public health care was that there was never enough money for it, but yet the banks start to go under, and they find trillions of dollars.
Yeah, they had to, didn't they? Yeah. They had to. I mean, and that's absolutely right. People are asking themselves now. I mean, that people are asking themselves that obvious question: is if they could afford to bail out Goldman Sachs and the like, you know, why can't they? Why, you know, if you can bail out the bankers, why can't you help the poor? You know, it's an obvious question, isn't it? You know, people aren't stupid. And I read the Financial Times, you know, with great enthusiasm, great interest, and there is profound unease, you know, in the centres of power about the way to move forward, absolutely, and so there's all of that. I mean, the other thing is that at a global level. The position of the US as the, you know, the most powerful country in the world has gone by the board, you know. So China and the, you know, I mean, there was recently a summit in Brazil of BRIC, you know, so that's Brazil, Russia, India, and China, which are the four large industrializing powers. And the statement, you know, out of that summit came a very clear statement that those countries, you know, see a multipolar world and, you know, do not see the future as one in which the US controls everything that happens. So those organisations like the IMF and the World Bank, that previously had a very hardline monetarist policy called the Washington Consensus, which they would impose on any third world country that needed help. Well, who's going to be telling those organisations what to do now? You know, in the past it was just the US told them what to do. I mean, I think it's all up for grabs now. You know, and I just think that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. So Oliver Stone has just been in South America and made a film by Hugo Chavez, and like left wing governments have like now swept the board in South America. You know. And I think that's partly because the US's hands have been so tied in Iraq and Afghanistan that, you know, they can't, the US cannot any longer just control South America in the way it did even 20 years ago. Then that's good, you know. So I think there's great grounds for hope and optimism. And it is just ever so interesting, you know. It's just like watching history being made, you know. And I think there's all sorts of stuff going on. Definitely.
And I wonder, because Naomi Klein, she came up with this idea of the shock doctrine, which I guess what I think of it as, and you might know a bit more, and correct me if I'm wrong, but sort of in a time of crisis, governments pass incredibly harsh sort of right-wing economic and social measures that squeeze the poor and the working class quite often. And this is done in a seeming sort of fanatic adherence to quote-unquote free market ideology. And they do this and they sort of say, this is the bitter pill we have to swallow to make things better and things. And they also do this in the wake of when sort of disaster, something massive disaster happens. So sort of like, you know, if there's a massive hurricane, for instance, let's just gut the social services of that city and remake it into this free market city or something like that. I'm thinking, I guess, a bit of Hurricane Katrina in relation to that. And I was wondering, do we sort of see now, because they keep talking about the fear of the spread of this economic, you know, economic problems and things, and they sort of create, almost, well, in some ways, seem to create this crisis, or at least create a fear of this crisis that gives them the sort of, gives them a bit more sort of moral authority to pass these incredibly harsh measures where they're talking about cutting people off of incapacity benefits and things, which who are people who are the least able to mobilize for their own rights and who are sort of, they have the most, they have quite a heavy weight to bear in life already and things.
I mean, I like Naomi Klein's stuff that I've seen. She did a very good film on Argentina and about the banking crisis in Argentina in 2000, early 2000, and No Logo. And I've read a bit about the shock doctrine, which is she equates she sort of says that, as I understand it, the CIA got interested in the use of electroconvulsive therapy, you know, ECT, on mental patients, and from that they sort of, the idea came of if you wanted to take control of the economic relations of a society, you create a sufficiently big shock and turmoil that you can then go and impose whatever economic relations you want. That's how I understand. I haven't read her book on it, but that's the, I understand is the nub of it. I mean, I think it has to be said that capitalist powers, in their building of empires and in their own countries, have been willing to use the most ruthless violent measures really for the history of capitalism, and so, you know, I don't think there's been a new thing developed that wasn't there before. And I think you know, many people have written about this. I can't remember his name. What's the name of the Australian, John Pilger?
Oh, yeah.
The Australian journalist, radical Australian journalist, who wrote the sort of history of neoliberalism, starting with the brutal overthrow of a popular government in Indonesia in like the late 50s, you know, American inspired, British helped, hundreds of thousands of leftists killed and tortured, you know, so that was that was just after the Second World War. I mean, if you look at the history of the British Empire, of the Europeans in Africa, of the US, of the Spanish in South America going back to 1600, you know, there's always been this. And it'll always be a struggle between fear and hope. You know, I mean, I think that's is how it always works. And the right and the forces with power will always threaten instability and try and say to the middle orders, if you like, the middle classes, you know, if you want security, support the right and support authority and help us crush the people at the bottom. That's the way it always goes, you know. Whereas the hopeful message is all the people at the bottom are always saying, let's build a better world, you don't need to crush us. You know, let the people in the middle and at the bottom get together and overthrow the tyranny from the top. But that's the sort of way it's always been, really, and the way it will go on being, I think. And you know, but I do think there are great grounds for hope. But I do think that right wing agenda, neoliberalism, you know, Reagan, Thatcher, did just get buried in 2008. I do think that whole free market ideology just died, really. So I think there's great grounds for optimism. And one thing I've been following with great interest in the last few weeks has been the upsurge of industrial unrest in China. And in a way, the whole Thatcher Reagan policy, the main thing of it was the globalisation of capital and saying to capital, you can go anywhere in the world, find labour and exploit it. And that meant that the labour forces in the industrialised countries in the West, you know, were always hamstrung, really, because once capital could move, you know, they just said to you, you know, either you cooperate or shut your factory down and go elsewhere. And so, but that's why, that's my opinion of why the left has been on the defensive for 30 years. And, you know, capital has been acting at a global level, but Labour has only been acting at a national level. And as long as there were 1 billion peasants in China who had no, you know, who were willing and had no choice but work for absolutely nothing, as long as there was always more of them to come along, you know, there was going to be a problem for Labour globally. But in the last 2 or 3 weeks, you know, there's been really significant Labour unrest in China, and the employers in China have been forced to concede, like doubling of pay levels or you know, significant increase in the face of industrial unrest. That's sort of, I hope, and it feels like the end of that chapter of the race to the bottom, you know, never be able to find the bottom. Well, I think we found a bottom now, you know, and I just do think that's very important news, I hope, you know. You know, so we'll see. We'll see what happens. But I do think that will be looked back upon as historic. Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, so the Honda factories in China and Foxconn, which is enormous electronics contractors who make all, you know, Apple Macs and Hewlett Packard printers and all of this electronic stuff for the Western markets, and they have just been forced by their workforces to, like, you know, to negotiate with independent trade unions and pay them more money. And I just do think that's important.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. And just before we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to add or any other?
No, other than that, I just think I just think we are in a historic period. You know, I think we don't know where we can go from here. Well, you know, it's not clear where things are going to go. But I would say that, I mean, I'm terribly optimistic, I am very optimistic, and I think it's trying to get your head on around what the context is. But for me, comparing us to where we were in the 30s, so the whole world is capitalist, that's one thing, which that's a new fact, yeah? So everybody is part of one economic system all around the world. I love the World Cup. I mean, I'm just passionate about the World Cup, and it just sort of reflects that unity of humanity, you know, to me. So that's the first time in human history we're all part of one economic system. For me, I think it really matters that we can't have another world war. You know, the scale of nuclear weapons is such that in the crisis in the 20s and 30s was this effectively, really, it was solved by the Second World War. Yeah, that's my opinion, as it seems to me. We can't have a world war in that way. I mean, we can't have an unlimited nuclear exchange between China, the US and Europe, because we're all dead if that happens. So you might as well write that off as an option, because it's just, you know, if it were to happen, that would be the end of the story. So that's not a way out for capital. And then there's this extraordinary background of peak oil and global warming, you know. So this is all against the backdrop of primary resources running out, and the danger of the threat of us destroying the whole planet's ecosystem. So there's sort of everything to play for, but we are in genuinely new territory, you know, and that's and that sort of is what makes it all so interesting. And to me, it gives you real hope, because it is like, you know, the lessons of the past aren't going to be enough now. We have got to make it up for ourselves and think it out for ourselves, because it is like, you know, none of us have ever been here before. And I just think that's great, because it's not like having to go over the same round, the same old loop and again. So bring it on, really, isn't it? And next time the G20, wherever it is next, God only knows, but I'm sure there'll be, you know, more protests at that. Yeah?
Definitely, definitely. Great, okay, well, thanks a lot.
No, my pleasure. No, thanks for talking to us.
Wonderful. Yeah.